Welcome to the ISF Podcast from the Information Security Forum. The ISF Podcast is hosted by ISF CEO Steve Durbin, and every episode he brings listeners features timely conversations, practical insights, and resources for global cybersecurity professionals. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today, Steve is in conversation with author and strategist Rahaf Harfouch. These two leaders discuss balancing productivity and creativity, as well as having a very practical discussion about how to give yourself and your team the time and space to focus, to think creatively, and to collaborate effectively.
Hi, Rahaf. Thank you very much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you've written a book, your most recent book, actually, Hustle and Float, Reclaim Your Creativity and Thrive in a World Obsessed with Work. That came out in 2019. So that was before the pandemic. And in it, you talk about workplace culture. You talk about creating healthy work habits to avoid burnout. Now, I'm suspecting that if you were writing it today, looking back over that COVID period, maybe you'd have changed it, maybe not. Tell us a little bit about the book and whether or not you would have made any changes and what is still relevant today.
Sure. So the premise of Hustle and Float is that there is a fundamental contradiction in a lot of office places between productivity and creativity, mm-hmm. where we have all these systems and ideologies and tools that we want for people to be productive, right? And so timesheets and making sure you're online on Teams all the time and all of these different ways that we consider what a good employee does and how a good employee is productive. Now, the problem with that is productivity, or our understanding of productivity, is based on an industrial revolution era thinking, mm-hmm. where we think that people have to be productive all the time, nonstop. This is problematic because for most knowledge workers, a lot of their skill sets are based on creativity. And creativity is not something that can be constant. It has a limited resource that requires replenishment and that requires recovery. So what ends up happening is that companies that are navigating very complex business ecosystem at the minute expect employees to be innovative, strategic, problem-solving, collaborative, but are creating systems of measuring performance that are actually undermining their ability to do so. And if I was to write this book again, I would actually add an entirely new section about the impact of our digital and technological ecosystem. Because as we saw over the pandemic, when companies rushed to get on Zoom, what ended up happening is that they just took all of the ways that they were measuring productivity in their offices and applied it to the hybrid space. Mm-hmm. So suddenly people were expected to have back-to-back Zoom meetings or back-to-back video chats. They were expected to be active with their mouse movements all day. They were expected to be demonstrating that they were actively working, when the research shows that being on video calls is incredibly draining, that people were suffering from more exhaustion, and that fundamentally the stress of living through the pandemic was further draining our resources, eroding our capacity to focus, to concentrate, to collaborate, and to be creative. And so I find that we have this misunderstanding of what modern-day knowledge workers need to actually thrive. And if we want to create cultures where they thrive, we have to drastically rethink how we think about performance in the workplace.
So how can we do that? What are some of the things that we need to be focusing on to achieve that goal?
Sure. So one of the first things that I tell clients to look at is to audit the technologies that they're using, whether it's their email policy or their chat programs or their performance measuring systems, their dashboards, and to ask, what behaviors are these technologies encouraging? Because again, on one hand, companies say we want people to really think about these big complex problems that we're tackling. On the other hand, we're interrupting them all the time with mm-hmm. emails. The average employee gets interrupted every 11 minutes, right. and it takes them 25 minutes to get back on task. So you start asking yourself, okay, well, is the technology that we're using, is it actively encouraging collaboration and deep focus? Or are we encouraging distractions and like presenteeism by expecting people to be always responsive and to be constantly available? And so just that tiny step, you know, how are we using the existing tools that we have and how can we change the policies, the meeting policies, the email policies to actually encourage periods where people are not being interrupted and where people can focus on the task at hand?
Now, one of the things that I think some people may be thinking, listening to you here, is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you're talking about the home working environment or the remote working environment. So organizations moving into this hybrid way. We had to do that very, very quickly, of course, during the pandemic. But the contrarian would say, well, actually, what's the difference? If I'm in an office, I'm working in a highly interrupt-driven environment. People are walking by, I'm deciding to go to the coffee machine or the water cooler or whatever it might be. So actually, being in the home, in my own environment, my productivity should be increasing. How do you answer that?
No. please stop. No, I'm kidding. I think I would answer that by saying, actually, the location doesn't matter. What right. matters is the culture that is driving the behavior. So if you are in an office where you have a manager that wants to constantly see you working, that is, you know, where are you going? How long did you take your coffee break for? Maybe you took a too long of a lunch. Oh, you got here after 8 or after 9 or whatever the operating hours is. That's exactly the same thing as your manager sending you a message on Slack or on Teams saying, why aren't you at your desk? Why aren't you active? Why aren't you logged on? So your colleague stopping by your office and your colleague pinging you, they're actually the same thing. What is different is how you actually manage the intent. What is the policy? If you in your office have a policy that says, we encourage people to actively take focus time and to have uninterrupted time, and you can say, mark it on your calendars, mm-hmm. whether you're in the office or at home, you're not going to be interrupted. And actually, office places have long been places of like decreased productivity, which is why so many workplaces are now rethinking open space office concepts, right? Mm-hmm. They're giving people rooms where they can go in and just work when they need to work and focus when they need to focus. And I think fundamentally, we need to understand that knowledge work is really made up of two parts. There's the collaborative part where you need to be with your team and it can mm-hmm. be loud and you can talk and you can chat and you can brainstorm. But every one of us also needs a focus part where we can just sit at our desks and just think about everything that we're supposed to be solving. And so for me, the location is not as important as the underlying culture of what are the behaviors that are being encouraged. And if you're being encouraged to be constantly available, whether you're at home or in the office, you're going to be distracted. It's going to undermine your performance.
And different people become creative in different environments, right? I'm thinking about myself here. So I'm probably at my most creative in a noisy environment. So if I want to think about something, and this for some people it may sound completely counterintuitive, but if I want to think about something, I'm probably more likely to want to go to a coffee shop where it's hustly, bustly noise than to take myself away into, say, a cupboard and shut myself, you know, off completely.
You don't have a thinking cupboard?
I don't have a thinking cupboard, no. It's not something, we moved house recently. It wasn't something that made the cut when we moved in. Mm. But do you know what I mean? So we're talking a little bit about the company, the organization looking at the knowledge worker. And for me, it's more about the knowledge worker looking at what they need to be more effective in doing what they're best at. Mm-hmm. So would it be fair to say that one of the challenges for organizations is to let go, to give some of that freedom back to the knowledge worker, to the individual, to determine how they can best behave, how they can best perform, and then measure, because we all like to measure, right? We're not going to move away from that. Measure it on output and quality and depth of output rather than on speed of reply on a Teams message, for instance. Is that where you're going with it?
Yes. I mean, the reason why this is such a complicated topic is because there are a lot of different stakeholders, right? You can't, right. Exactly as you said, you can't just point fingers at the business and say, here's what managers need to do. The reality of it is every part of society needs to do something. The individual needs to think about and understand what they actually need to be creative. Mm-hmm. You'd be surprised at how many people don't understand their own creativity, have never actually thought about in a constructive way, what am I most creative? What is my creative work cycle like? What are the environment, circumstances, tools that I need in order to be creative? And as you mentioned, that changes from person to person.
Right.
The company, as we've talked about, is about company culture and policy. And then there's society, which is how we as a society talk to each other about success, talk mm-hmm. to each other about who deserves to be successful and what success looks like. So on the role of the individual, it's really about looking at, okay, what do I need to be creative? And there's sort of two parts to this question. The first part is understanding yourself. Are you a morning person? Are you an evening person? Are you somebody that works in small sprints? So I have friends that are authors that write books in 15 to 20 minute increments.
Okay.
And it works really well for them. I need a longer time. I need like a 2 hour chunk of uninterrupted time because it takes me a really long time to get focused. Mm-hmm. I'm a night owl, so it needs to be later in the day or in the evening versus my friend who is like an early bird who gets up at 6 and does like 3 or 4 of these 20 minute sort of sprints.
Right.
The second part, which often gets in the way from an individual level, is that we have internalized the idea that productivity and overwork in particular are signifiers of our commitment to our own success. Mm-hmm. Meaning, if I am not visibly demonstrating that I am struggling and sacrificing and staying late and hustling and grinding, then society, my friends, my boss might not think that I am deserving of promotion, of advancement, of recognition. And there's a sociological phenomenon called work devotion, and that's exactly what it is. We have developed, as social creatures, a way to signal to each other our devotion to our job. So when you ask me, for example, how was your weekend? And I say, oh, I worked so long. I've got so much on my plate. I'm so busy. I'm not getting enough sleep. I've got 46 clients. What that is doing is I'm not just bragging about my busyness to brag about my busyness. What I'm actually saying to you through this like language that we've created is I'm important. Mm-hmm. I'm committed to my success. I want you to know that I am devoted to the company, that I'm devoted to our mission. I want you to recognize my willingness to put in what it takes to succeed. And so that belief system becomes problematic because we're encouraging the exact type of behaviors that end up creating burnout. And when you're burned out from a neuroscience, from a physiological perspective, you simply cannot be creative, innovative, strategic. People who are burned out cannot be collaborative. They are not empathetic. They are exhausted and they make a lot of mistakes. So you have this really bizarre narrative that is completely contradictory, where on one hand we say we really value creative thinkers, we value innovative thinkers, we value people that can be agile and adaptive and be curious and learn. And on the other hand, we say, yeah, but we're only going to reward you if you work so hard you make yourself sick.
And very often, people who are moving down that road to burnout don't realize they're doing it, do they?
No, I find burnout has become one of those terms that we throw around a lot, and many people don't have a true understanding of what it is and how it impacts us and how it impacts teams. So burnout just means chronic depletion. It means that you are repeatedly putting your body and your mind, your emotional, your mental energy into a state of depletion, and you're never giving yourself a chance to recover. So it's like you're always at 5% and you're plugging that phone in, mm-hmm. and you're unplugging it when you're at 15% and then going back to 5% and then, so you're never giving yourself the chance to fully recover. Now, burnout can actually be felt in three different ways. The first way is the way that everyone is familiar with, which is physical depletion.
Right.
What people don't understand is the second way, the second impact is actually called cynicism and negativity. Your amygdala, the part of your brain that measures threats, you know, the fight or flight mm-hmm. system, it becomes so activated that you're more likely to misjudge a team member's tone. You're less likely to be trusting. You're less likely to give them the benefit of the doubt. You're more likely to be irritated and short-tempered. So it really erodes trust in a team. And the last impact of burnout is personal efficacy. Personal efficacy is all of a sudden you start to think, I can't do this. This is too hard. I don't know if I can make it in this company. I don't know if I can stay. And the self-doubt that it creates ends up resulting in less quality of work and more mistakes. And so burnout as an occupational hazard, as it was described by the World Health Organization, becomes dangerous and toxic to organizations that need their teams to be innovative, strategic, and collaborative. And I think that managers need to understand it's not just people being tired. Mm-hmm. It's people being incapable, really physiologically incapable of developing trust on teams, of communicating on teams, and of feeling good enough in their jobs to bring their best caliber of work forward. And if you work in a job like cybersecurity, where you need to be detail-oriented, you need mm-hmm. to be on top of it, you need to be constantly thinking, constantly problem-solving, constantly responding, having a team that is burned out is really dangerous.
So how do we spot it, and what can we do about it?
So oftentimes, you can look at both sort of in-person body language and digital body language. So if you notice people on your team that are repeatedly staying late, if you notice mm-hmm. people not being as engaged as they normally are in meetings, disassociating, not as responsive, if you start to notice a shift in email or digital communications, maybe they're communicating outside of working hours, maybe they're less responsive, any shift in a change, mm-hmm. I think that's an important signal for you to sit down and say, hey, you know, is everything okay? The bigger, more challenging aspect is to look at how the company manages products and manages projects.
Right.
Is your timeline realistic? Are your teams constantly working overtime in order to meet deadlines? Are they feeling exhausted? Ask them. That is often the most overlooked aspect. Ask people, are you feeling like you're getting the time to recover? Are people not taking their vacation days?
Mm-hmm.
all of these little symbols start to indicate that people are feeling depleted. And I do want to make a comment that I think that regardless of your industry, one of the biggest things that we have learned from the pandemic as a collective stressor is that the way we consume information right now has a big impact on our nervous system. So living through pandemic fatigue has put our nervous systems in a state of prolonged stress, which we're not supposed to be as humans. When our ancestors got chased by a predator, they would eventually escape, hopefully, and then they would go home and be like, whew, that was a close call, and they would recover. What's happening here is that we've been chased by a lion for the last 2 years, and it's never stopping. So you have the pandemic fatigue, you have doom scrolling, you have all the news that we read around the world every single day. We have an unlimited amount of tragedies and anger and outrage and conflict. All of that has an impact on your body and on your mind. And so companies also need to know that the technological ecosystem that we are working in is also depleting their workers' resources, like much more than pre-pandemic. And so the conversation isn't just what's happening at the company. It's also what's happening in the world and recognizing that your staff might not be coming into the office with a full tank. Maybe in 2019, they had 3/4 of a tank and, you know, it was okay. But in 2019, the World Health Organization said that burnout was an occupational hazard. And so fundamentally, we have to both look at existing behaviors, spot signals, and we also have to look at how we are managing resources, especially with staffing. Do we have enough people? There's talent shortages. How are we going to make it so that people have adequate time to recover?
And for lots of organizations, what they're doing, whether it's within cybersecurity or across the organization in general, they have multi-generational workforces now, don't they? Is there a difference? Do, you know, baby boomers, for instance, that are still left in the workforce, do they respond differently to, say, Gen Z? Or how do we sort of deal with that complexity as well?
And I think there are nuances between generations. I think one thing to note is that, and this maybe takes a little bit longer to answer, but every generation that has entered the workforce was made a societal promise. So the boomers were told, if you work really hard, you will have a stable retirement, a pension plan, you will have consistent labor. Gen X were told, if you work hard enough, you will have more upward mobility than your parents. You'll be better off financially. The millennials were told, we're super special and we're very unique. And if we just do our best and be ourselves and just show up and participate, that the world will reward us with unlimited opportunities, which obviously did not happen with the majority of our generation graduating in the 2008 financial crisis. What's interesting is that the millennials were the first generation where that promise was broken. Millennials are the first generation that are going to be less well off than their parents. We're the first generation that have had limited lifetime earnings. The potential for lifetime earnings has been curbed by a pandemic, two recessions, and an entire sort of unprecedented crises, once in a lifetime crises. And what's happening is that Gen Z is looking at all of this and they are developing a sense of anxiety and hopelessness about the future. So with Gen Z, when you talk to them, and I spend a lot of my research speaking to young people, they are afraid. There is climate catastrophe. So just as a data point, the American Psychology Association has indicated that in young people, there is this emerging subset of anxiety called climate grief and climate anxiety, which is when you feel an absolute sense of doom, impending doom, and helplessness about the world. And so this is part of the reason why quiet quitting became such a thing, because fundamentally, millennials, some Xers, and a lot of Gen Z are looking and they're saying, what are we working so hard for? What is the point of working so hard and of participating and of giving a company my all if we don't even know if we're going to have breathable air in the next 50 years? And so it's really navigating from an empathetic perspective those different pain points. So if a boomer is, say, worried about some of their pension plans or thinking about retirement, it's the same angst. The feeling is the same, but the root of it is different versus a Gen Z that says, where are the jobs? You know, I can't get hired and I am feeling really scared about the environment and I don't know if subscribing to all of this hustle culture is actually going to get me what I want. So the interesting thing is that there is a similarity in the emotional states that the generations are feeling, but the contextual narratives is completely different, which is why you'll have some boomers look at the younger generation and say, well, they don't want to work. You know, they're not interested in working hard. They're just whining. And it's like they don't understand that to be 22, 23 in today's world is very scary for a lot of people. And it is far more disrupted and it's far more complex and it's far more confusing than what, say, our parents or grandparents experienced when they entered the labor market.
So what can we do Given all of this challenge that is out there, what can we do either as individuals or indeed as organizations to help address some of the issues that we've just been talking about?
I mean, it's a really big question, right? I mean, ultimately, where I always start is to audit. Audit everything. Mm-hmm. Audit yourself. Audit your beliefs. Audit your team. Audit your leadership style. Audit your technology. You really have to take a step back and look at the way that we've been using technology, the way that we've been measuring performance, the way that we've been thinking about success. Because so often what happens is we don't realize that we have adopted or absorbed viewpoints, opinions, technological tools without really thinking about what they mean. It's like that story about water by, I think it's by Foster Wallace. I don't remember his name. But, you know, the story about the two young fish that are swimming and they cross an older fish. And the older fish says, "Good morning, boys. How's the water?" And the fish kind of nod and keep swimming. And then a couple of minutes later, the younger one turns to his friend and he goes, "What the hell is water?" And I think that's the concept. We are in water. Our technology is water. Our managing best practices are water. Our strategy principles are water. Our economic models are water. And we have just been living in them as though that is the only way and as though that is the true way. And in reality, it's just a choice that we've made. Mm-hmm. So if you are a leader, I would really start with looking at the questions that I tell people to ask themselves. Where did you get your definitions of success? How do you measure high performance in your team? What makes a good worker at your company? What behaviors get rewarded? Who are your star players? What makes them star players? As an individual, how closely do you associate your professional identity to your work ethic? When you look at your technologies, what does the way that we email, the way that we talk to each other, the frequency, the expectation of communications, what does that say about the unwritten rules about our organization? Are we actually understanding young people? Are we spending time talking to the people in our organizations to understand their experiences? Because it's not really a tech problem, it's a human problem, it's a connection problem, it's an empathy problem. So when you start asking yourself these questions, you take yourself outside of the water, and then you say, is this a pool I want to swim in? Mm-hmm. And then you realize if it's not, there are so many different kinds. Like, I'll give you a quick example. Every CEO that I've ever spoken to has always considered themselves a data-driven leader, an evidence-based decision maker. I've yet to meet a leader that says, I just make decisions on a whim. Every leader that I meet says, we look at the data, we make the way forward, and that's how we determine our strategies. And so then when I say to them, okay, well, the 4-day work week has now been piloted in multiple countries around the world and unanimously has been a success. We have the data that shows that if you do a 4-day work week and without a reduction in pay, you're still mm-hmm. paying people the same, yeah. productivity goes up, work-life satisfaction goes up, morale goes up, retention goes up. And then when you ask them, okay, well, knowing this, you should just flip to a 4-day work week, the resistance, we can't. Where does that resistance come from? That resistance does not come from data. That resistance comes from the expectation of how we have had things. It comes from anchor bias. It comes from confirmation bias. I once had a CEO tell me, we don't need to do a hybrid work survey. I know everybody wants to come into the office, so there's no point in even doing a survey and asking. That's confirmation bias. I've had leaders say, oh, well, the office, you know, that's just the way that we've done things. That's anchor bias, the way that we used to do things, determining it. I've had leaders say, well, I could never imagine us working in the way that we need to work using hybrid methods. That's functional fixedness bias. That's when you cannot see a different use of a system than the way that it has always been used. And so when you have to really look at from an ego perspective and understand that the resistance to these ideas is not technological, it's internal, it's psychological. And that is the biggest one. And that's really hard to say to people because ultimately you kind of have to poke the ego and say, look, you might have to be uncomfortable. You might have to face the fact that you think that this is the way things should be because that's the way they've always been. And you have a blind spot because you're not exploring all the different opportunities that technology can be used to enable collaboration.
Loads of things in that conversation we just had for people to take away, to actually think through and perhaps, hopefully, do differently. Rahaf, been wonderful talking to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thanks to this week's guest, Rahaf Harfouche. We'll be back with a new episode in a week. In the meantime, as always, we ask that you take 10 seconds to pull up this podcast on whatever device you're listening and give us a 5-star rating. If you have a little more time, you can even write a quick review. That helps other listeners who might enjoy our content find us. And we also want to make sure to introduce you to the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, which goes in depth on the hottest topics in information security. In every episode, ISF analysts hand-select active security professionals from ISF member organizations to discuss how the implementation of ISF research is uniquely applied to their real-world context. We hope you'll listen, and of course, we'll put a link to that show in our show notes. If there's a topic or a question that you'd like us to cover in a future episode, let us know at securityforum.org, which is also where you can find our catalog of past video and podcast episodes, as well as ISF's research, practical tools, and guidance related to discussions like today's. The ISF podcast is produced by TalkBox and Tavia Gilbert, with music by Alexander Filipiak, senior producer Katie Flood, mix and master by Kayla Elrod. Thanks for listening.